The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Hello and good evening, and welcome to the Doctor's Inn with me, Dr. Jenothra Archer Cartwright. I'm a family medicine specialist and consultant medical doctor who I treat everyone from children to the elderly. And I want to thank you for joining with us tonight for all things health, wellness, and things that pertain to the Bahamian society. We got an interesting show tonight, going to mix it up a little bit because there was a really great video that I saw earlier that I decided to kind of focus the show around. It's interesting that, you know, where we are in terms of everything we've been talking about COVID for quite some while, and it seems to be some light at the end of the tunnel. I know that the government has recently kind of, they're about to remove the mask mandates for most instances. However, I was a little disappointed because mask mandate is still on for schools and school children, which I thought was really odd and really interesting because they're really the ones that do need to have the mask on, especially for their social and mental development. So we'll see how that goes along, but I'm glad to see that we're moving in the right direction. A little slow for me, but you know, what can I say? But good nevertheless. But in this whole conversation about COVID, we are really, really far behind. As I've mentioned many times before, the rest of the world is kind of looking now at vaccine injuries and what does that mean? And just recently, there was a call to just end all vaccination campaigns regarding to the COVID-19 vaccinations or shots. And the World Health Council, this group actually did a presentation and where they kind of talked about their reasoning behind that. Dr. Buhari, I think his name is, really an English cardiologist. He was talking about his experience of how he was vaccinated and how he changed his mind about everything after seeing what was going on, after what happened to his dad. And so we're going to play that. It's kind of long, so we'll play most of it, and we'll break up parts of it so that we maybe can discuss some of it, but it's really long and it may take this week and next week, so hopefully we'll get through all of that, but it's a really interesting clip, and I think it's a good way to see how, you know, people have evolved over time in the way that we've looked at this entire situation. And there's so much that we can learn. Hopefully we'll get to the end of his discussion. Probably not, because we're a little behind right now. But he also talks about things that we need to do so that something like this never really happens again. And that's really, really important. How do we not get back to this really, really unpleasant place where we kind of let things get to this point? And so, of course, brought to you by Medical Concierge Services for all your medical health needs. We are located on Collins Avenue, 972 Collins Avenue. You can give us a call, 326-1521. And that's if BTC gets our phone lines up, because we had a problem today. So hopefully that's all going to be rectified. But it seems like there were some problems with the phones. So you can also reach us on our WhatsApp line, 432-4010. That's our new WhatsApp line, because the old one, we're not using that anymore. So please, if you're having any weird encounters calling the old WhatsApp line, please revert to the new WhatsApp line. That's 432-4010. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. On Instagram, it's medical_concierge_services. And you can find me most Tuesday nights on Facebook as well. The Doctor is in with me, Dr. D. Please like the page so that you can get us, even if you can't get us on 96.9. But tonight we're not streaming live. We're actually going to download this later so that you can get the video. So I'm going to see if I can share my screen so that we can listen to the video. We're going to go through parts of this because he says some very important things. And in case you don't understand some of it, I'm going to explain what he's talking about, because I've been having some of these very same conversations with my colleagues and with other persons about what's been going on in the medical industry and how did we get here. So you will have to let me share my screen, host. That would be the producer. If you could let me share my screen so I can play the video, or I can see if I can just play it from the background. But I really would love to have it there so that it's on here. So we're going to try that one more time. Nope. So host, that would be Mr. Producer. Can you let me share my screen so that I can bring up that video? But there's a lot of interesting components of this. He really talks first about how we got to this place in the medical industry so that we could even kind of make all of this palpable. And then he also then talks about his personal experiences, and he goes on from there and comes right down to the point of how do we not get there again. And so I'm making a request to share my screen, but I'm not. Producer, you just have to let me share my screen, but that's not happening. So I'm going to try and send him this link so that he can maybe share it himself. I wanted to control it so that we can talk about it, but we're just going to play that from about 13 minutes, 35 seconds, and then kind of see how far along that we get. So producer, if you could play that, if you're not going to let me share my screen, if you could just start playing that video, that would be great. And so we can let everybody in the audience kind of join in with that. Okay, now I think that they just made me the host, so that's pretty good. Let's see now. Right, we're going to go into, there we go. All right. So this is the beginning of World Council for Health, and they are basically having this conference, this press conference, in which they basically use peer-reviewed papers and call for the immediate and complete halt of the vaccination program. So that's the doctor's name. He's Dr. Malhotra, Asim Malhotra. And he actually produced some of these papers that he's going to go through.
wanted to
black up yesterday.
But she says she bumped into a wall when she's running after the churn them.
Yeah, but last Saturday, you see her arm was all black and blue, right?
What you saying? You think something wrong between her and Jack?
I ain't sure, but you know Jack is a jealous man. I hear him and Cora last Friday. I hear him say he hear Cora have eyes for Junior.
Now, you know that ain't true. Cora is a good woman. Does mind her business, take care of them churn and go to church every Sunday. So what you think we should do?
I think we should report Jack, you know. Cora don't say nothing, but silence hides violence, and we don't want to line up in the cemetery.
Not me. I ain't getting in nobody business, then Jack come after me, and I land up next to Cora.
No, man, we could call or text Crime Stopper. And remember, we can even get some grocery money for our tip.
Remind me again how this work.
We can call them in Miami at 328-TIPS or 328-8477. Or when we in the island, call toll-free at 300-TIPS or 300-8477. And if you don't have no minutes, use the Crack Crime Bahamas app, and we could text them. And the messages get on mix-up before it leave your phone, so nobody can know what you're saying.
So what we waiting on then? Let's go earn some grocery money.
You've been listening to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM.
The Access Accelerator Small Business Development Center is here to help small businesses throughout the entire Bahamas. To better serve you, we've made it easier to contact us. Call 461-7232, WhatsApp 359-0626 or 359-2394, email helpdesk@sbdcbahamas.com, or submit a ticket when you visit our help center at accessaccelerator.org. The Access Accelerator, empowering small business.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.
Hello and good night. We're back again. Apparently, the clip was not playing on the radio side, so we're gonna try that again. Not sure exactly what was going on. So, Mr. Producer, maybe you can play that instead. And you can start around about 15 minutes. Start at the 15-minute mark and let's see how that works.
With a concept called willful blindness. Some of you may be aware of it. So it's something that all of us actually in different circumstances are very much capable of. And willful blindness essentially is human beings turning a blind eye to clear facts in order to feel safe, avoid conflict, reduce anxiety, and to protect prestige. And there's a history of many instances where even institutions have become willfully blind. Whether you look at situations such as Jimmy Savile or the midstaffs with the NHS, Harvey Weinstein, even to some degree, controversially maybe, me saying this, even during the whole history of what happened during the Holocaust, many German people were probably willfully blind to what was actually really going on in those concentration camps. So I think it's something we need to be aware of that we're all capable of in certain circumstances. And for me as well, and as I'm going to mention through my talk, you know, I was willfully blind, certainly in relation to the vaccines and the harms, until I wasn't. And that's why it's crucial that we tackle this both with compassion, because there are many people who are still willfully blind. And I think, you know, remaining in echo chambers and pointing fingers isn't getting us anywhere. So we have to have some compassion for people who are in a position different to us. But the way to tackle it is really with the facts and to speak with empathy to people. And that's what I think we need to be doing now as we move forward. So what's worse than ignorance? The late, great Stephen Hawking tells us the illusion of knowledge. So I'm going to essentially, over the next 50 minutes or so, discuss my recent findings. So this is a publication in the Journal of Insulin Resistance. It's peer-reviewed. Just to mention briefly, I know some people have been commenting on social media. Somebody mentioned I'm on the editorial board. There's very strict rules with the journal. It's like criticizing, you know, Richard Horton as the editor of The Lancet to ignore his editorials. It doesn't make sense. I don't have any financial link with that journal at all. I'm there really as in an honorary capacity. And this publication was basically initially discussed with the editor. Of course, as happens with many publications for research, is it something you're interested in? She said, yes, Asim, but of course, this is very controversial, and I'll have a look at it and then decide whether it needs a peer review, and it will go for a peer review independently. So this took several months, actually, and it went for an independent peer review and now published. And I spent about 9 months actually conceiving the ideas, thinking about it, going through the data meticulously. And for reasons that will become apparent, I mean, I was literally eating, breathing, and sleeping this stuff for the last 9 months. So I'm glad it's finally published, and I'm going to present some of the findings today. It's in two parts. One of the reasons I also chose this journal is because the Journal of Insulin Resistance is one of the few medical journals that doesn't take funding from industry. And it also allowed me to write 10,000 words. Most medical journal articles won't get over 1,000, maybe 2,000 even research pieces. I felt I needed to write this extensively, not just to cover the science of the COVID vaccine as I saw it as a clinician, but also to understand the root causes of the failures, because without understanding that, we can't move forward in a constructive way. So let's just very briefly, you know, I think to understand the part, one needs to acknowledge and understand the whole. You know, before all of this and even ongoing, we have this big problem in the UK, and this is replicated through many parts of the world. You know, we have a stalling life expectancy since 2010. And in many parts of the country now, we now have many people living longer with chronic disease. So we're getting sicker, essentially. We're not getting... So that shouldn't make any real sense. You know, with everything we know, with all the information out there, with access to information, with so-called the wonders of modern medicine, why is it that our health is now starting to get worse? And I've got to some degree, think from as my responsibility as a doctor, and even to think about the medical profession, and think about, are we actually doing the best that we can do as a profession? And are we actually inadvertently maybe contributing, not deliberately, to the worsening health crisis? So this is one of the most important slides of my talk, so I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this. And I think if people understand this in depth, then it explains many problems actually going on with the world today. So this is the evidence-based medicine triad. This is an analytical framework for teaching and practicing medicine. And I think all of us here would want, you know, our health, our mental health, our physical health to be optimized. That's called improving patient outcomes.
Yeah, so we just paused for a second. So what the good doctor is kind of talking about now is he's going to go and explain how, I guess, over the last 15 to 20 years, how we practice medicine. And it's an evidence-based model in which we look at, you know, we use our clinical knowledge as well as the scientific evidence and different parameters to come up with the best answer for things. And then we use that to make guidelines. And so he's going to talk about that and how we've kind of fallen away from some of that. And that's why we are where we are. So you can go on and continue, producer.
This is, you know, doctors, clinicians, healthcare practitioners, in order to improve patient outcomes, treat illness, manage risks, reduce suffering, we use our individual clinical expertise, the best available evidence, and last but not least, which is crucial, taking into consideration patient preferences and values. Now, this makes sense as a concept, but then if you take a step back and understand one thing, if the best available evidence is biased or corrupted or incorrect, and or you're not taking into consideration patient preferences and values, you are best going to get suboptimal outcomes for your patients and at worst cause harm. And the problem we've got now is that evidence-based medicine has been hijacked. It has become an illusion by commercial interests. And the reason for that is, and it's, for me, this is at the root of the healthcare crisis, is based upon a number of seven sins, if you like. So biased funding of research, research that's likely to be funded because it's likely to be profitable, not beneficial for patients. Biased reporting in medical journals, biased patient pamphlets, biased reporting in the media, commercial conflicts of interest, defensive medicine, and last but not least, an inability for medical curriculum that failed to teach doctors how to comprehend and communicate health statistics. And this is crucial to understanding also the benefits and harms of the vaccine. Next slide, please. So how reliable, how good is the best available evidence in it from a broad perspective? We've given these concepts, but how good are is evidence-based medicine? And the sad reality is...
Let's pause right there.
You know, John Ioannidis, who I cite...
Yeah, so... What he's saying, and this is a discussion that I've had recently about problems with medicine, and it has been quite infiltrated by money and pharmaceuticals, and he's going to talk a little bit more about how that happened. But a critical thing is the communication between patients and their doctors and being able to distribute that information in a manner, and that requires the doctor having really good knowledge of the evidence and what he's doing, as well as being able to communicate that information to his patient. And that is the last of the seven that he talked about. A lot of the other ones have to do with bias, which is fundamentally a really big problem when you want to come to the truth, because bias skews the truth. And financial, you know, gain has kind of gotten into there, and he's going to talk later on about how all these different aspects of the medical industry are sponsored by the pharmaceutical companies, and how that's infused into media, infused into the way things are presented. It's very interesting and very complex, and something that we have to really look at. We can continue from there.
As being the probably, you know, I would say a Stephen Hawking-like figure in medicine. He's the most cited medical scientist in the world, professor of medicine and statistics at University of Stanford. And he wrote this great paper, which you can look up online, 2017, called How to Survive the Medical Misinformation Mess. And what he says, he names a number of factors behind this medical misinformation mess. One is much published research is not reliable, offers no benefit to patients, or is not useful to decision makers. Now, I think he's being a bit polite there. He wrote a previous paper many years before this, actually entitled, which is the most cited paper ever published, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. Okay? Most healthcare professionals are not aware of this problem. Don't think your doctor knows about this. Then doctors, and this is something part of medical training, and it's not difficult stuff, actually, when you actually spend time looking at it and understanding it properly, most medical professionals lack the necessary skills to evaluate the reliability of usefulness of medical science. And then last but not least, patients and families then lack relevant, accurate medical evidence and skill guidance at the time of medical decision-making. And this is also one of the things he writes in his paper, in a different paper. He says, ignorance of this problem, even at the highest levels of academic and clinical leadership, is profound. Just stay on this slide for a second, please. And I can tell you from my own discussions, you know, I've spoken to people at the very highest levels, whether it's, you know, one was a current and two former Secretary of State for Health. I've spoken to people like the chair of the BMA. I've spoken to people, the chair of the medical colleges. I've had one-on-one conversations with people. And it is true that this issue is, even at the very highest levels, not fully understood. When the whole vaccine mandate debate was going on in the NHS, I did a lot of work behind the scenes and an opportunity I had mainstream media to basically say this is unethical, unscientific, and we're going to lose lots of NHS staff, and it wasn't even practical that we should introduce this. And in one of the conversations I had at the time was with the chair of the BMA, who I know very well. And once I'd become aware of the evidence suggesting there was a problem with this vaccine, I explained to him, and he went and spoke to Sajid Javid, and we had exchanges, and those messages were going there. But one of the things he said to me when I spent 2 hours walking him through the data that I had at that point, he said, "Asim, I can tell you one thing. Most of the people, certainly in health policy that I know, and you know, this may include the chief medical officer," he said, "I don't think they're critically appraising the evidence in the way you are." Next slide, please. The other interesting thing that John Edesis points out in his paper is that the greater the financial and other prejudices in a scientific field, the less likely the research findings are to be true. Any thoughts on something recently that's been extremely lucrative? Next slide. So, you know, I've been a campaigner on this issue for about 10 years. I became very much aware there were big problems in medical research. I looked into it in a lot of detail because I, as a clinical doctor, was seeing more and more patients with chronic disease, more and more people being over-medicated, more misery, and I knew that population health wasn't improving. Of course, the obesity epidemic is part of that as well. And then in 2018, I was invited to speak in the European Parliament with a talk entitled "Big Food and Big Pharma, Killing for Profit?" And one of the things I think that's really important for people to understand as well, trying to take the big picture view before we home in on the vaccine, is that drug companies have a legal obligation to produce profit for their shareholders. They do not have any legal obligation to give you the best treatment, although most of us would like that to be the case. And this is pointed out by Peter Wilmshurst in the Center of Evidence-Based Medicine in 2014. Peter Wilmshurst is a cardiologist. And one of the things he points out is that the real scandals is that regulators fail to prevent misconduct by industry, and that doctors, institutions, and medical journals who have a responsibility to patients and scientific integrity collude with industry for financial gain. And by that point, for me, I got to a situation where, you know, I gave this quote, I said this, you know, in the European Parliament, I said, "Honest doctors can no longer practice honest medicine. We have a complete healthcare system failure and an epidemic of misinformed doctors and misinformed and unwittingly harmed patients." Again, bigger picture view. So what is the history of the drug industry? Because of course the drug industry are, most medical research now is sponsored by the drug industry. Most of those clinical decisions that doctors are making in the consultation room are coming from studies sponsored by the drug industry. But there is a huge problem in terms of the impact of one over-medicated society. So Peter Gosher, co-founder of the Cochrane Collaboration, many years ago did an analysis, and his estimates are that prescribed medications now...
Yeah, so he's going into now, which is something that I talk about a lot too, because even as a doctor, I base a lot on my foundational learning rather than what always is given to me, which makes my perspective a little bit different and allows me to question a lot of the so-called evidence that's put my way or studies or whatever. It's very different being able to read the conclusion of a study that's told to you and being able to analyze a paper for yourself. Those are very different things. He talks about that later. Hopefully we'll get to all that, but we're gonna at least get to about half of this. And so the key thing there is that the way that medicine is structured right now, it's very heavily on the pharmaceutical side. So those of you who know me or you're my patient, you know that I'm a traditional medical doctor. However, I really do try to limit the amount of medication that I prescribe to patients, because this is the problem that I've been seeing for a while. We have really become so reliant on drugs. And there are a lot of things that we can do before getting to drugs and medication. There are great drugs out there that do a lot of amazing things. But also we know that the more pill burden that a person has, you have to now consider side effects. We have a comment in on Facebook and says, I'll read the first one first. It says, when is all said and done, the vaccine makers must be held, I guess they would want to say responsible. However, those of you who have known, we've talked about this before, they, especially with this most recent thing, they are really not going to be end up being liable for anything. A lot of our governments signed that away. And so if you look at places just like the UK, you'll find that the government itself is the one that's paying people who have had issues with it. The governments are either actually doing that or the governments are not claiming any form of liability. So we're going to continue. Let's see how much of this that we can finish off tonight.
Are the third most common cause of death after heart disease and cancer because of side effects, and they are mostly preventable. Okay, that's pretty extraordinary stuff. And one of the other root problems behind all of this is there is a huge history, without naming any particular drug company here, of fraud. You know, so between 2009 and 2014, most of the top 10 drug companies were found guilty of committing fraud for hiding data on harms, illegal marketing of drugs, which reached, you know, about $13 billion, US dollars. And what Peter Gosha points out in this paper in the BMJ is he says that, you know, actually what happens is they are essentially, nobody gets fired, you know.
I don't know what happened there, but basically what he's saying there is that
from the sales of the drugs that have been
the companies are getting fined, but not at the rate that it's not stopping their profits. He continued.
Have been fraudulent due from the fines. So it's a cost of business for them. It's not about conspiracy theories. It's a cost of business. And I'll come on to later explain exactly what's going on with these big corporations and why they do this. And his solutions, and this has nothing has changed, by the way. So nothing has changed in the system, despite all this evidence of lots of harms that have happened to patients. And he says it's time to introduce tougher sanctions as the number of crimes, not the detection rate, seems to be increasing. Fines need to be so large that companies risk going bankrupt. Top executives should be held personally accountable, so they would need to think of the risk of imprisonment when they consider performing or acquiescing in these crimes. Okay, so just trying to be devil's advocate here. Okay, Dr. Malhotra, that's fine, cost of business, blah, blah, but isn't the overall effect of the drug industry great? Isn't all these amazing, innovative drugs, you hear politicians talking about innovation, all these new devices, all these new drugs, isn't it overall going to be beneficial for us? Nothing could be further from the truth. So this is data, and I'm going to show you some other data in a minute. If you look at data from France, and this was... this looked at almost 1,000 drugs that were approved by the regulator in France between 2002 and 2011. And what they found was most drugs were copies of old ones. So essentially, they're changing molecules here and there. They patent a new drug. And one of the reasons for that is, for basic science research, the drug companies actually end up spending about 19 to 20 times more on marketing than they do on research and development of basic science, you know, new molecular entities. And then they looked at, okay, what drugs actually had an extra therapeutic value were proven to be beneficial, better than the previous drug for patients. And actually that was around 8%. But if you look at the third just look here, more risk than harm than benefit, you'll find that 15.6%, so double the amount of drugs that were found to be beneficial, were proven to be more harmful than benefit. So what does one conclude from all of this? We just go to the next slide. If you look at the data in America, Marcia Angel, the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, did an analysis between 2000 and 2008 of drugs in America and basically found that only 11% of new drugs were truly innovative and 75% of drugs are essentially copies of old ones. What else does she say? You know, what does the the former editor of the highest impact medical journal in the world. She says, it is no longer possible to trust much of the clinical research that is published or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians or authoritative medical guidelines. I take no pleasure in this conclusion, which I reached slowly and reluctantly over my two decades as an editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. Is she alone? I wrote this in my piece, towards the end of my piece.
Yeah. So what he's discussing there is that when we talk about all the innovation and everything like that, we see a massive amount of new drugs that are coming onto the market and we think, wow, they're putting so much into researching these drugs. But what they found when they really did an analysis that was a large chunk, 75% and sometimes even more in cases, that these weren't really new drugs. These were old drugs that they kind of tweaked and remarketed as something else. And there was only about 11 to 15% of new drugs that had new research that brought any value to the table. And so in my practice especially, I'm very kind of cautious of new drugs. I kind of let them go through a period of time. And then you kind of see which ones are really, really good and which ones aren't. I find that the older drugs go through a lot more vigor and are kind of, there's some staples that have been through it all, and those ones are always there. So the newer drugs, they're pumping them out faster, but we have to be a little bit more cautious. And a lot of them are not new or bringing anything to the market. A lot of them are just old drugs that are revamped, and it's because of profit. So we're going to move forward. Go on.
Richard Horton, the editor of The Lancet. And I wonder whether this is a cry for help, because I wonder whether Richard Horton, and I know Richard, by the way, he lives near me. I bump into him in the street every so often. We have a chat. He's a very, very nice chap. I haven't talked to him about this specifically, but he knows I've written about him. And I wonder whether there is a conflict there, not in a bad sense, but in the sense that The Lancet, of course, takes a lot of money from industry, but maybe Richard also himself knows that there's other big issues. And he basically mentioned in an article he wrote in 2015, you can look this up, that he had it was a Chatham House Rules meeting organized by the Wellcome Trust. He said many eminent scientists were there. The conclusions essentially were possibly half this published literature may be untrue. Former editor of the BMJ, Richard Smith, in an article a few years ago, wrote about the fact in British institutions, there is a big problem with covering up research misconduct. And he wrote, something is rotten in the state of British medicine and has been for a long time. What's the overall net effect of the pharmaceutical industry, certainly in the last few decades? It's very clear. It's been negative. Okay? Even if you just look at the waste, the colossal waste, and who's paying for it? We are paying for this. The taxpayer is paying for this. You've got big corporations making all this money. They also then don't pay their taxes. So we've got a system, if you like, which, it's almost like we've got a system which steals from the poor and is giving to the rich. And you wonder why society is disintegrating. Next slide, please. So what's actually going on in British institutions? So there was an inquiry set up by Norman, I know Norman very well, who was then the chair of the Science and Technology Committee in Parliament. And he set up an inquiry into research integrity in 2017. And Peter Wilmshurst just highlights a few of these issues. And he submitted evidence. I'm just going to quickly go through them point by point. So he says, academic institutions bear responsibility for the pressure to publish for career advancement that can result in research misconduct. A record of prominent publication is likely to attract future funding, which institutions demand, and good publicity, which institutions desire. Other pressures for misconduct come from association of academic institutions with industry, such as when investigators or other institutions hold patents or shares, or they receive payments from industry. So there is a financial pressure to publish research that will be profitable for the company and to suppress negative findings. Some publications are simply organized criminal activities, which may be at the behest of the sponsors when prominent academics are paid large sums of money to publish false data by industry, or a sponsor may be one of the victims when payments of conducting research are made to investigators who simply find medical journals.
Okay, we're going to pause there, and then we're going to jump ahead about 5 or 10 minutes. So he's talking about the way that the journals are published. And so a lot of our data, when scientists get the data, we publish it inside these journals or these magazines for medical health, but even them have been kind of infiltrated in the sense where you can pay to get your journal placed. And, you know, he goes on to look at the varying ways that they change the data in order to look a specific way, especially if you have companies that are paying for their studies and they're putting them in there. I think we can skip about 5 minutes ahead and then we'll start again and see where we are, as he talks a lot about the data stuff, which I know a lot of people won't be too interested in. Hopefully we'll get some of the photos.
is university research over the years, since the 90s, there's more and more funding coming from the drug industry. It used to be much less. And I'll come on to problem shortly. Next slide, please. So again, just as part of my advocacy, and again, this is relevant, this is all in the paper, and don't worry, it'll all make sense when you come onto the vaccine, is that I worked with a medical oncologist for a year, and I convinced, and I sat on a table with all the chairs of the medical oncologists, Royal College of Physicians, Royal College of Surgeons, chair of the academy, and I said, listen, and this is partly based upon what was available, the BMJ launched a campaign in 2012 to wind back the harms of too much medicine. I said, we should coordinate this with the medical profession. Do the medical profession and the medical Royal College chairs, do they understand that this too much medicine issue is a major issue, major problem, problem with fraud, problem with over-medication? How do we tackle this? So I convinced them, and this was a long, again, peer-reviewed paper, two of the co-authors, I was a lead author on this, two of the co-authors, one was the chair of the GMC at the time, and the other one the chair of the medical Royal Colleges. And basically, one of the conclusions as well about, we said there needs to be a campaign to wind back the harms of too much medicine. And with the healthcare system as it is, doctors also have an ethical responsibility to reduce a wasted use of clinical resources, because in a healthcare system with finite resources, the patients delay. Okay, again, really important slide. Again, crucial. What's happening? And one of the things we mentioned in our paper is about, when we come back to the evidence-based medicine slide, informed consent must involve transparent communication of risk and benefit of any intervention, the way that they can understand, using numbers they can understand. Okay, so misleading health statistics is a major issue. There are many ways of presenting a benefit, relative risk or absolute risk, okay? So if you communicate relative risk, and I'll explain that very briefly, and this is not rocket science, you know, a GCSE math student could understand this very simply, okay? So, if you communicate relative risk as opposed to the absolute risk, which you should be doing, it can lead lay people and doctors to overestimate the benefits of a medical intervention. So let me give you an example. If you look at data on the use of statin drugs, cholesterol-lowering drugs, to prevent stroke in people with type 2 diabetes, you look at that data. If you look at that data, it suggests that using a statin gives you a 48% relative risk reduction over 4 years. That sounds pretty impressive, doesn't it? What does it actually mean when you look at the data? It actually reduces the risk of suffering a stroke from 28 in 1,000 to 15 in 1,000. Therefore, you've reduced 13 out of 1,000 strokes. If you look at the randomized control trial data, so 13 over 28 is 40 times 100 is 48%. But for an individual, what it actually means is your absolute risk reduction is 1.3%. In other words, and this is when I practice medicine, when I talk to my patients, when that data is available, I always communicate in these terms. I will say to that patient, take this pill, you're 48% less likely.
In this particular area, he's talking about the way that we do journals and studies and how the information is presented. There's a big issue with statins, and these are the medications that we use for treating cholesterol. So there was information that came out a while back that, you know, you should use the patients for risks and different things and stuff like that. And what he did is he took a deeper look at the information on the study itself and realized that the way that they represented the information, and there's different ways, absolute versus relative risk. When they commented on the relative risk, it made it seem like there was this big reduction in a stroke and heart attacks because of this particular drug. When you look at the absolute risk, the risk specifically to the patient, the number is actually a lot lower. And so these guidance and regulations, if doctors don't properly understand what they meant and they only get the conclusions of these studies, then that is where you have this kind of consensus that's not really based on reality in a sense, and that we need to be cautious and careful of this. Let's go ahead, jump ahead about 5 minutes into this. And see where we land and see if we get to any of the COVID stuff. We only got a few more minutes, five more minutes, and then I'll kind of wrap it up and we'll do the rest of this next week.
Next slide, please. What about Omicron? I did put this in the paper. We only had about 3 months of data earlier this year, but this is pretty extraordinary stuff. Again, Omicron, how useful is the vaccine or the traditional vaccine we've been using to prevent a COVID death from Omicron, according to real world data? If you're over 80, you've got to vaccinate 7,300 people to prevent one COVID death. 17,000 next decade younger. 30,000, 63,000, 167,000.
Okay, great
this
place to
pause. This is the absolute benefit of preventing a COVID death. Probably.
So what he explains now, I kind of jumped ahead because I wanted to get to a little bit of the COVID stuff before we went, is that when he looked at the real-time data of these studies, and you look at what your benefits and your risk, and I've talked about a lot, and even in the oldest group of people in which you're probably more prone to COVID and you're a little more scared in that group, it would require you to vaccinate 17,000 people before you were to save one person or give any form of benefit. This is not even considering the risk. And as you get younger and younger, as you get into the very young people, you have to give this drug to almost 200,000 people to see any form of benefit. And when we now start looking at the risk versus the benefit, you can see it becomes very, very small. So the way that they presented the information told one particular story, but reality tells something else. Continue.
The best case scenario. Now, there's something else that's important to note. The original trial, randomized, supposed to correct for everything, quite a large trial, about 40,000 people, done by Pfizer and even Moderna, did not show any statistically significant reduction in COVID death. Now, for me, and there may be lots of reasons for that, it's something to think about because it makes you wonder, hold on a minute. The gold standard trial didn't show any statistically significant reduction. Now, the argument could be it wasn't powered, it wasn't enough people, but if 40,000 people wasn't enough to show statistically significant reduction in death, it means the benefit in reducing death is probably very, very small. It's not non-existent, but it's tiny. And we come back to shared decision-making. Who was told about this? Were any of you told this? No. That's where we need to move forward. We need to look at this in a bit more granular way. Okay, next slide. One of the other issues as well to mention briefly, which probably won't surprise you, when I spoke to the chair of the BMA, I mean, it's interesting. I said, you know, he said, Asim, I think most of my colleagues, and this is historical as well, and it may surprise you, many people in health policy actually make their decisions on media stories. So the media reporting on it. He said to me, I think a lot of my colleagues are getting information on the benefits and harms of the vaccine from the BBC. And we know that media storing is not, media reporting isn't very accurate. This was published in JAMA Internal Medicine a few years ago, looking at US, how accurate were health stories in terms of explaining the actual benefits or harms or whatever an intervention. And of 5 of 10 review criteria were basically unsatisfactory. Costs, benefits, harms, absolute risks and benefits, quality of the evidence, comparison to new approach with alternatives, okay? So who's controlling the media? Well, certainly in America, there's a huge control of the media by sponsorship by the drug industry. Less so here, but it's still a major problem. Okay. You may stop and say, hold on a minute, see? Okay, fine. Media aren't reporting it correctly. You know, some of these doctors may be getting information. But we've got regulators. The regulators are going to, you know, we should listen to them. Last night on GB News, Dan Wootton, and of course this needs to happen. We have to get responses from the regulator, went to the regulator who said, we've looked at the yellow card scheme and we can't see any link between cardiac arrest. The yellow card scheme isn't the way to look at it. It's a very interesting, carefully worded answer, by the way, from the MHRA. What's the problem? BMJ investigation done by Marion DeMassi not so long ago basically showed, and in most of the funding of the many countries around the world of the regulator comes from the pharmaceutical industry. Okay, 65% of the FDA, 86% of the MHRA. Now, many doctors don't know this. I gave a talk at the BMA annual conference in a fringe meeting. The chair of the BMA was gobsmacked. He didn't believe me. This is before it was published. I said 86% of the funding of the MHRA comes from the drug industry. They didn't believe. These are people who are going on TV and saying, this has been independently evaluated, right? Most healthcare practitioners, next slide, please. So Donald Light, in that BMJ piece, who's a sociologist who looked at the regulator over many years and how they've evaluated different drugs, this is basically what he concludes. Can we trust the regulators, essentially? No, according to him. It's the opposite of having a trustworthy organization independently and rigorously assessing the medicines. They're not rigorous, they're not independent, they are selective, and they withhold data. Doctors and patients must appreciate how deeply and extensively drug regulators can't be trusted so long as they're captured by industry funding.
Okay, right, so we're going to stop there.
Do we have any high-quality evidence?
Yeah, so we're going to stop there for tonight. Basically, the end of that talks to, he's pulling in the ties between the drug companies having so much financial control over both the media and the regulators, which is very problematic. So even a lot of the doctors were from the media and from sources that were basically being financed by the same people who were creating the medication and the drugs, which is very, very problematic. And we call that a conflict of interest. And a lot of people aren't aware. And I think what COVID has done, it has brought to light that a lot of these regulatory bodies are actually so heavily funded by the people that they regulate, which is very, very strange, that they are, in a sense, cannot be depended upon. And so we look to them to give us guidance and understanding for how these drugs are supposed to go, but they are essentially being funded by the very same people. And so this conflict of interest became a problem because the source of information, which is the media and these regulatory bodies, were heavily invested in the very thing that they were promoting. And this is what's coming to light because of all of this, as people look to answer questions on why particular things were done and why they weren't done in a particular way. And this particular group is highlighting this to show that, you know, we've kind of given a lot of our power away for the last few years because we really, really trusted these systems at play. And even some of the medical people were unaware of the type of influence and bias that was going on. And so these are things that we really have to focus on in the medical industry as we move forward, as we look to take care of our patients and do what is right. But I think the key thing that I have learned throughout this entire experience is that critical thinking is very, very important. And that we have to be able to analyze data for ourselves. We cannot be sheep. And we have to go back to our foundation, our scientific background. And if we are to stick with that, as he mentioned, the evidence-based model requires both the professional opinion of the doctor, the evidence itself, and you must take in consideration the patient. A really big thing for me, allowing the patient to know as much as you can. And that means that you yourself also have to be quite informed in order to have the proper balance and to have a healthy, really good healthcare system. And if we refocus on those things, then we can realign ourselves and we can kind of get out of this. If we don't make this a learning experience at minimum, then we are doomed to repeat the same path over and over again. I also agree with the presenter because he talks about the large amount of medicines or pills that we have come easily into pushing on our patients and that we should take a step back from that and just kind of go back to our fundamentals of health. Very, very, very important to do that. And I would hope that our Bahamian people would try to also see that factors for COVID-19 were these health risk factors, and that we would try to make ourselves as healthy as possible and do the best that we can for our own general health. And this is a time for more a national sense of putting a priority on healthcare. And that's really what it's all about. All of us being safe, all of us having a healthy and fulfilling life. And we seek to do that. And that's what the show seeks to do. And we're going to play the other half of this because it gets much more interesting on the other half of this. But that was the foundation of what he was talking about, giving the story of how pharmaceutical are involved, the media, our policymakers, and how them being in such a close relationship creates problems when we are trying to solve healthcare issues. Because one thing science doesn't need, science needs to be unbiased. Just like how justice should be blind, science must be unbiased. That is the foundations of all scientific knowledge. And so I want to thank you all tonight for listening in. I want you to share this video if you enjoyed it. I'm going to put up after we finish next week's second half, I'm going to put up the full extent of this video so everybody can take a look at it for yourself, because there's a second presentation on this, which is a little bit more medicine-y, and you have to take a look at it in terms of pictures and slides, but it gives the pathology of some of the things that we're seeing in terms of side effects. So it's really, really interesting. So look out and like the Facebook page, The Doctors and Me, Dr. D, brought to you by Medical Concierge Services. We will see you all next week, and thank you for tuning in. Good night.
You've been listening to Guardian Radio 6.9 FM.